You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist, and of course, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded on the evening of the 5th of October, 2024. Some years ago, I wrote what has become a fairly well-known article on Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. And I interpreted it as essentially a form of alienation. He didn't really become a bug. He thought he was, or acted as if he was. I don't believe I've ever done a broadcast on it, but today we're going to do another very well-known work from Kafka, and that's The Trial. Kafka was a Jewish nationalist. And I didn't bring up that angle in my article on the Metamorphosis. He went back and forth. He was essentially a series of Jewish cliches. Upper middle class family, hated his father, extremely neurotic, obsessed with sex, generally miserable. Went back and forth from Zionism to socialism. Never quite sure what he was. He was engaged a few times, never married, and he died of TB at the age of 40 in 1924. And the bulk of his writing was done over the course of the war. The Trial was written by 1915, but since Kafka burnt 90% of his work, his literary heir, was supposed to burn the trial, too, and did not. Max Brod was his name, who died in 1968, was his inheritor and was trusted with his manuscripts, and he was supposed, you know, a lot of this stuff was not ever supposed to be published, and The Trial was one of them. So it was written in 1915, but didn't get published, I believe, until 1925, after his death. Now, for those of you who are familiar with Kafka and the Metamorphosis, or The Castle, for that matter, which I'll mention as well, there seems to be a few themes, but I think it's very superficial to reduce things to the confusion of modern bureaucracy or the modern state. Something is much deeper here. So let me give a rendition of the plot. And I wrote in my article on the Metamorphosis that the plot isn't all that interesting. And it's really only an excuse to lay out this series of images that he wants the reader to picture. The hero, so to speak, is a man named Joseph K. In The Castle, the man's name is just K. This man, on his 30th birthday, is arrested. The men who arrest him don't seem to be cops, and they don't really know what they're doing. In fact, they're not even sure if this is the right Joseph. And there's some reason to believe that it isn't, but it doesn't matter. They arrest him in a very strange way. Now remember, this is being written in Bohemia in the waning days of the Austrian Empire. But the men who arrest him simply say that they are working under orders. The law is a very vague conception, which never gets defined in the course of the story. They never tell him, in fact, no one tells him, what he is accused of, the details of his alleged crime. But he does realize that resistance wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, Joseph is a high-ranking banker. He is one of the leading executives at a local bank. Therefore, he lives off usury. The odd thing is that once arrested, he lives a normal life for the next year. You know, he's not in a holding cell. It's nothing like that. It's a very odd kind of arrest. I mean, he goes back to work. But he did have people notice him get arrested, both at his house and the bank, and word spread. Clearly, the man has been observed for some time. In fact, they say so. His landlady is a Frau Gubach, and Fräulein Birchner is both a neighbor as well as someone at the courthouse, because courthouses here seem to be anywhere, in people's attics, in people's back rooms. The residential area and public areas are always confused, very much like a dream would be. Joseph then seeks out Birchner's company, because just like Kafka himself, Joseph is obsessed with sex. Both Kafka himself and Joseph are porn addicts. Again, cliche Jewish problem, associating pornography, whatever that was at the time, with Jewish life. He tries to seduce Birchner through his apology of the disturbance that this caused and if it upset her, whatever. But there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of time or place. The only time we really get is the fact that it's his 30th birthday. He's told that cross-examinations, whatever that might be, will start at a place far away on Sunday. Why Sunday? Because, you know, nothing's ever open on Sunday, especially then. But no time is ever given. He finds the court, after traveling for some time, very, very little in terms of directions. It's in a slum tenement. And he's even told that everyone's attic has a courtroom in it somehow. These are labyrinthine buildings. Again, very much like a dream. From the outside, it looks like a slum. On the inside, it's slightly better than a slum, but clearly a public building. He never knows where he is. So he picks a room at random. He even says that maybe my guilt is going to guide me to the right place. Very surreal in this sense. And as he's wandering around, he's pretending to look for someone to kind of cover over his embarrassment. He sees lots of children there too. Remember, this is supposed to be some kind of a courthouse. He reaches the fifth floor, and his random choice, of course, is correct. He's told that he's an hour and 5 minutes late, although no one ever told him the time for this. And the room that he walks into is stifling. And there's so many. Everyone's an officer, it seems, with long black coats, very Hasidic, and beards, though it's not clear who they are. Everyone's wearing a badge. He doesn't recognize any of them. I don't know if these make reference to Jews or not. But then this gets interesting, because he doesn't really defend himself, because he doesn't know what the issue is. He refuses to defend himself, and the room bursts into applause. He doesn't know why. He has no idea how he's expected to act. So whatever rebellion he has is very weak. Now, one of the reasons we might think that this is the wrong guy is that the judge, quote-unquote judge, says that, oh, this is the house painter. No, he is a high-ranking banker. He's not a nobody. But that doesn't seem to matter here. The judge then says, well, you know, I have no obligation to hear this case, but I will anyway. There's no conception of jurisdiction. But when he talks about his high position, everyone laughs at him. You would think that would matter, but it doesn't. But these questions, especially is he a house painter, suggests to him that they don't really have a solid case against him. He shows the judge disrespect, or the magistrate. He takes his notebook in anger, eventually finds out that some of the notebooks that he comes across are, yet again, pornography. Clearly, it's something on his mind. He's angry at this pointless arrest. He then sees in another room a woman attacked. He's forced to stay in his place. And in just this series of images, the woman seems to go along with this. A lot of vague symbolism that Joseph has no idea. He storms out of the main courtroom and several other rooms in disgust, not really sure if anyone's even paying attention. But he decides to go back. Now, he doesn't get another summons. He just wanders back the following Sunday at 9 a.m. because he figures, well, that's when everything opens. The fact that there was no summons suggests that he is giving legitimacy to this court. Now, it's unclear whether the court has legitimacy or not. The woman who was accosted is there. She apparently lives there in exchange for, you know, maidly duties, among other things. And she likes Joseph, likes him in a sexual way. This comes up again and again in this story. The attacker turns out to be a law student named Berthold. Doesn't like the idea that she's talking to him in a that kind of a way. And yet again, the woman is carried away physically and goes along with it. There's a court usher that takes him to yet another law office. He sees a lot of accused men who have no idea what's happening. People are attacked in the hallway. He has no clue. He wants to leave, but it turns out this time he can't. In fact, the air is so bad and so stuffy that he gets lightheaded. He's taken outside and revived. However, those who took him outside, because they're so used to the air inside, they get sick from fresh air. Now, he's at work, and remember, there's no real place or time here. Again, very surrealistic. He sees two cops who arrested him. Whatever, I'm saying cops, I don't know what they are. No one knows what they are. Their names are France and Willem. They're being beaten in a room. You know, it's kind of like your dreams, where you open one door, and you have no idea what, you know, there is no place here. Everything seems to happen in one place and in every place. And they're being beaten because of how they treated him. Again, assuming this is the right guy in the first place. And he feels very guilty about this. Joseph says, you know, maybe if I pay you off. And they said, well, you can give me all the money you want. If I don't do this, the whipper says, I'm going to get in trouble too. Money and position don't seem to matter here. Which makes this more interesting than your typical, leftist version here. Left-right distinction doesn't matter a whole lot at all. But Joseph has an uncle, Carl, who is a landowner. Sees him at the bank, and Carl's worried that this arrest, people are talking about it. No one knows what it is, and when you don't know what it is or what it's for, people start inventing things. So he thinks that the family's going to be disgraced here. So he introduces Joseph to Herr Holt, who is sort of a defense lawyer. Yet again, there's a sexualization because he has a maid, Lenny, L-E-N-I, who tells him, and by the way, the women are everywhere. They all seem to have some sexual connection to him or someone else. They're always in some position of servitude. But he says, you know, you're going to have to take a plea. If you ever want to be free again, despite the fact that he's actually been free this whole time, he has a meeting with Hold and to have sex with Lenny. He forgets the meeting and goes off with her somewhere. All the women in this story want to help Joseph, but generally are no help. If anything, they are distractions. Joseph then learns that the system is one large machine, seemingly with no founder, with no purpose. Documents disappear. There's clear bias against the defendants. Their rules are unclear or arbitrary. There's no obvious right to counsel. And Hold, the defense attorney, sort of, tells him that there are no rules here. But I know people, and if you want any chance whatsoever, you're going to need a lawyer, not because a lawyer can plead your case, but because a lawyer knows people. And that's the only way to get anything done. So if there's any power to be found, and Hold is a strange character because he clearly isn't doing well. You see the same thing in The Castle, too, another work, that he's in bed most of the time, clearly very sick, and Joseph is extremely suspicious of him. Now, the trial, sort of, if you even want to call it a trial, as it drags on. Now, the time of this story is from his 30s to his 31st birthday, although even that's kind of strange. I think the Broad might have misplaced the chapters. But in his banking career, he doesn't have time for his clients anymore. So he's being attacked by people at work who would like to take his place for this very reason. He can't concentrate on much. And it's not like there's something to concentrate on. It's just the arbitrariness of it all. It's not like he can make a case or that even matters. One of the deputy directors has taken over his job, at least temporarily. And then he meets another very weird, very arbitrary figure, a man named Titorelli. They use an Italian name because he is a courtroom artist, but it's not like we normally think. These guys who, in certain jurisdictions, because you can't have TV cameras, they draw pictures of the proceedings. Well, that might be part of it, but he's more of a portraitist. He's not a very good one. But he knows, or it seems, more about the law than his defense attorney does. He surrounded this Italian man by girls who were clearly white slaves. These women who seem to be sexual objects, not doing anything, they're just laying around. Now, this is where he gets some legal advice. Apparently, there are three kinds of acquittals. And again, this has nothing to do with your case or even money. There's three kind of acquittals. The first one almost is never to be found, and that's an absolute acquittal. How we would define the term acquittal. The two others are apparent and deferred. Absolute acquittal, of course, is the best, but almost never happens. In all other cases, it never ends. You're constantly, even if there's a sense that you're innocent, anything can change at any time. All it takes is one clerk to look at your paper saying, oh yeah, we didn't do this, and now all of a sudden you're rearrested. Deferred is something where you're kind of acquitted and you're free, but it can show up at any time. You're constantly being watched and you constantly live in fear that this could happen. So you're really never going to be free of this. Any time like this where Titorelli lives, you have court offices there in his back rooms too. Now, as he's meeting with his defense attorney, he meets, depending on how you read, of course he wrote in German, he meets a man named Block, who is a client, a much longer term client than he is. He tells Joseph that the court can't be understood rationally and can never use reason to analyze what's happening. And in fact, it's so bad that many people rely on superstition. Block has been on trial for 5 years, and just doing anything he can to get out of this, he really is very servile in front of his defense attorney. Now, the hold in this period of time hasn't done anything for him, and he says he's fired. Hold then says to him, very upset, you know, if he's this big name, why would he be so upset here? But he says, you know, without a lawyer, you can't win. Of course, with a lawyer, he can't win either. The only chance you have is a 1 in a million shot that I'm going to speak to the right person. Now, another Italian is supposed to arrive. A partner at the bank that he works for is supposed to show up where he is, North Europe, and Joseph has been asked by the bank to show him around. And he figures, well, I know the cathedral pretty well, and it's a big tourist destination anyway. He's going to be there the next day. He arrives the next day. The Italian partner is nowhere to be found. In fact, we never see him. He's in the cathedral by himself. The priest is at the pulpit apparently preaching to somebody, calls him by name. He's also the prison chaplain, by the way. He's the one who wanted Joseph there, and says to him that your case isn't going well, which could mean anything at this point. The priest then tells him a parable that's been analyzed to death. Actually, it was published separately. And it's a simple parable, but it really resists any kind of normal analysis. And we'll get back to this here in a little bit. There's a man who seeks access to the law, not a particular law, but the law. Almost like coming to St. Peter's Gate, there's a doorkeeper keeping him from it. Beyond, there are many more gates and many more doors with other doorkeepers in a row far more powerful than the one before. The man actually stays there, a man from the country, it's said, is there for decades. Living right there at the gate, in fact, he grows old there, goes senile, goes deaf. And then finally, near the end of his life, he hasn't moved. He says, how come I'm the only one? I'm the only one who showed up here. How come there haven't been other people searching for it? And the doorkeeper says, this has been constructed only for you. That is the door. And now, as he dies, it's going to be closed. With that parable, Joseph is being told that there is no truth. There's no justice. This parable is deliberately vague, cannot really be understood. And the priest ends by saying, don't accept what's happening as true, or good, or just, only as necessary. A year later, on his 31st birthday, two men, not the same men as before, show up at Joseph's apartment. Of course, in this year, nothing really has happened. They very harshly and roughly take him. They do not speak, they don't say a word. The men drag him out of town. They even pass a policeman. These men are not policemen. They prop him up on a rock. They have a knife. They pass it back and forth. They suddenly speak and are very polite. He's meant to stab himself, but in fact, they do it for him. And they murder him. And the last words are, like a dog. It's the final line. That is a thumbnail sketch of the trial. Obviously, there's a mountain here to unpack. But because Kafka was a self-conscious Jewish nationalist, despite not really being raised in it, he makes a clear distinction between Eastern Jews and European Jews. Jews from Poland and Ukraine are not assimilated. The Hasidics are very powerful. The Western Jews are mostly assimilated, his father being one of them, and he doesn't like this idea. I'm not talking about in a story, this is how he really is. So, being a Jewish nationalist most of his life, it could never be taken out of contender, of being contender for analysis. Of course, it's a huge part of this. Notice, in this year, he has been free. Despite him being completely preoccupied, he's never put in a cell. And even just that alone, the lack of charges, this unreasonable but very complex, incomprehensible, corrupt system, however, like in the story of the castle, is widely accepted. In fact, he didn't really know about this until he was arrested. He had no idea. That this disastrous, massive machine, juridical machine, ever existed, let alone existed in the slums that he randomly wanders into. Interestingly, when he's first arrested, he says to himself, or I should say, he says that someone has lied about me. So he thinks they've got the right guy. And he says, someone has been spreading rumors, blood libel, about me. The parable I mentioned is called Before the Law. Literally, physically, before the law. And just like Joseph in his arrest and everything else, the man at the gate doesn't put up a fight. He's there for decades, doesn't put up a fight, reaches old age. It's a journey to get there, so he brought provisions. He even tried to bribe the guy. Again, money doesn't matter in any of this. And the gatekeeper accepts the bribe, not because he needs the money, or not that it matters, but just so you can say to yourself, I've done everything I could. Doesn't want the guy dying and saying, oh, if I just would have bribed him, it would have happened. That's as far as it goes. People accept this, and worse, at the courthouse, in front of his defense attorney, he's surrounded by people who not only accept the system, but are absolutely groveling. There reaches a point, and we're going to cover some of this here for the rest of the lecture here. I just gave a thumbnail sketch of the story, and now we're going to get into specific details. Joseph seems to think that he is the right guy. But his case is also new, so he's seeing people who not just accept the system, but grovel before it. These are broken people. Events here, as you probably noticed, have no real cause and effect connection. There really isn't a plot, because there doesn't seem to be any time or place. Interpretations of this are all over the place. Of course, the idea of the Jewish mind being distorted by passion. Remember, you know, Joseph is a usurer, or at least works for usurers, and is sex addicted. Kafka personally, as well as this guy, sex is everywhere. Now, it's my opinion, and this may change as the years go on. I did not develop this for the metamorphosis, but for the trial. This is what it's like to be a Jewish nationalist in Bohemia at the end of the Austrian Empire. They were a privileged caste of people. Of course, no one could talk about that either. But this is a mind, specifically a Jewish mind, as E. Michael Jones will tell you, having rejected Logos, having an entire culture based around the rejection of Logos, is taken by its passions, and everything is distorted. I started off by talking about the fact that Gregor in the Metamorphosis wasn't really a bug. He was deluded into thinking he was, but he wasn't. Just like here, in my opinion, the courts aren't really that bad. But in his mind, he's not getting his way for once, and therefore everything seems irrational and dark. We all know that Gentiles are not supposed to be, and I'm assuming that they're Gentiles here. It seems to be the case that how dare they judge a Jew, and I think Joseph is representative, if not literally a Jew in the story, certainly is representative of it. 30th birthday, you start off with the idea that once you turn 30, this is when self-reflection develops. This is when maturity, your adult responsibilities come crashing down on you roughly around that time. Kafka, elsewhere, he says that, you know, this is a bureaucracy. Most of his stories have something to do with this kind of a bureaucracy, but that's not really what it's about. That's a symbol of it. But this is supposed to be a free country. This is supposed to be a law-bound country, and it was. Everyone that he comes across concerning the court is following orders. They don't really know what they're doing. They just know they have specific jobs within the system. They're even referenced by their titles far more than their names. They're not sure even what the nature of these cases are. And all the people that he comes across in these various courtrooms, no one is accused of anything, but they're all in serious trouble. Even when he's arrested, these men bring them to their superior, and he doesn't know what's going on. You really can't, and Joseph, just like in the case of the Metamorphosis, dream, delusion, reality are all mixed together. I think this has to do with the distorted mind, living and obsessed by these passions. The absurdity of the court is him projecting his own problems onto it. And he does say, and we'll get to that in a minute, he does admit that in a few different places. So eventually he understands that there's no evil here. No one's evil, no one's good, it just this is this huge organization. Hold, the defense attorney, says that this is a limitless body. It's a machine. He uses words like malice and injustice, but that doesn't seem to be the case with anyone he comes across. Truth, guilt, innocence are irrelevant, and given what we know about Hold and the nature of the so-called acquittals, even knowing people doesn't do anything. Now, you would think a banker and a usurer would have no problem in court. I mean, this is the end of the Austrian Empire. This isn't like today. But one of the most interesting things here is that money doesn't make any difference. Some people have said that it's lies turned into a system, but there's no evidence that anyone's lying here. They just have a job to do. Several writers have brought up certain philosophical points, one talking about René Descartes, worrying about the idea that this evil god, evil genius, may be just implanting thoughts into his head. You know, the brain in the jar nonsense. That the seeker of truth, if this is true, can't succeed. It's very hard to, Descartes was worried about. How do I know that I'm just not a disembodied brain being fed images? And that's where the cogito comes from. My personal being can't be denied. Of course, St. Augustine said the same thing. But this is supposed to be the rule of law, just not the rule of Jewish law, necessarily. Someone mentions Plato's cave. Most of you know what that is. That there are people who are chained to rocks in a cave with a flame behind them, and those rulers of the cave project images, shadows, on the wall. People who've lived there a long time believe that's all there is. That's not true, of course. There's a light that only very, very intrepid souls could ever get to. Kafka, at least most of the time, suggests that there is no light whatsoever. The fact that the court is in this tenement house, the images, the slope ceilings, everything seems distorted. Everyone is a court official, the foulness of the air. And again, he is told that if you're here long enough, you're going to get used to it. And just like in the story of the castle, no one else seems to think that the system is irrational. It's just not serving them the way that they would like. If truth exists, then people in the system have no way of understanding it. Now, he doesn't come out and say it doesn't, which may have something to do with his several times converting to Zionism, which was a minority view among Jews in Europe at the time. That something is because the court makes it so. Like Plato's Euthyphro. The question of piety is a pious act what the gods approve of? Or is the approval coming from the fact that it's a pious act to begin with? The Euthyphro problem, which Socrates lays out. Of course, Socrates in that dialogue is on his way to court, which will eventually kill him for impiety. Euthyphro says, of course, the goodness and the pious act, what the gods say it is. Socrates says, well, the gods and all these myths, they disagree one with another. So that position doesn't make any sense. And they go back and forth. Euthyphro says, well, in big issues, you know, he's turning in his own father for an unjust killing, which at the time was a very bizarre thing to do because it's the family is the only thing that mattered. And yet the gods would have accepted this because Zeus did something like it. But these kind of issues come up in Joseph's mind. And of course, there's no solution to them under these circumstances. Even the parable from the priest is very stripped down. There is a little bit of light because as the seeker of the law in the parable dies, he sees a tiny glimmer of light in the distance. This system ends only in death. Even his defense attorney talks about this, the contradictions that are very clear. People don't even apologize for the contradictions. It's simply taken as something necessary rather than true. It seems that people are guilty just to begin with. This reflects the basic Jewish neuroticism that's almost now cliche among them. Hold even says, well, context may matter, but that's no guarantee. Hold and the painter, Titorelli, says, well, they've never seen a real acquittal before, The only thing that they've seen operate is some kind of influence. And even that, very vague. Now, I mentioned the nature of acquittal here, which essentially dooms anyone who is a part of it. I mentioned absolute acquittal, which is actually being innocent and you never have to worry about it again. That never happens. Apparent acquittal is temporary. In fact, the other two kinds are temporary. Apparent acquittal can be reversed at any time, as I said before, even years later. A new group of officials can come in. They want to reopen the case. They can. They don't have to have any particular reason for it. The third, as I mentioned before, is protracted. That's the one that never ends. You're always on trial. You're not, you know, going to prison or being executed or anything. But the process never ends. And in German, the title of this is a process. It's been anglicized to mean the trial. But it's the process. The men that he sees in court are broken. All throughout chambers and in the hallways and everything else, and they never know what they're in for. Now, I mentioned the Euthyphro and Plato because in Platonic terms, or in anti-Platonic terms, something is legal, something is just because the court says it is. Not because it's that way, not because it's true or untrue. Again, necessity matters, not truth or falsehood. Descartes goes so far as to say himself that X is true because God says it is. And he says this, and you have many Protestants, this is the nominalist point of view, that there are no universal truths. God is, something is true because God says so, not because it is. And the claim is that that maintains our understanding of God as absolutely free and hence arbitrary from our point of view. And this was challenged. You know, this is the heart of the Protestant idea. Descartes was one of the people who justified it in the Renaissance. It really comes down to the fact that truth, if the nominalist view is to be held, and Occam believed the same thing, we can't talk about universal truth. That's beyond us. All we know is what God says is true and real. And not for any other reason. So it's the parental, you know, because I said so, which is no good parent ever really says that. I shouldn't say that. But they don't like the idea that God somehow is bound by his own creation or the forms in logos. And there's no conception of logos in any of this. But the nominalist point of view, again, suggests that truth ends up being what the powerful say it is. Leibniz has the famous best of all possible worlds, the simplest laws with the highest level of justice. And he condemns Descartes' point of view, the Protestant point of view, because they mocked him for the best of all possible worlds, that what we have, despite our sins, is the best that we can hope for, because you're not seeing the whole. We see evil as something horrible happening to us or someone we know, not seeing the broader picture. That most of the good things, in fact, all the good things in our life, came from pain, came from suffering, from childbirth on down. What we think is evil exists only because our point of view is too limited to see its place. It's kind of like in a musical score, dissonance. The idea of tension and then release at the end of the piece. Now, how that is connected to the court? Hold tells him that this is a whole. This is a unit. It's in a state of eternal equilibrium. Is straight from the story itself. Everything is connected, but it doesn't seem to be an organism. Now, I mention this both for the parable, again, which was published separately, which is now a part of the novel. Both the man in the parable and Joseph. There are a few things to note. Again, money doesn't work. This isn't about bribery. This isn't about money. That never comes up. That's never an issue. Joseph sees himself as a man who's mastered worldly wisdom. He's above all of this. You know, people, when they get arrested, they start yakking to investigators because they think they're smarter than they think that they could talk their way out of it, not asking for a lawyer. Well, not that that's relevant here. But it's the same idea. He thinks that, yeah, I'm a usurer. I'm a banker. I'm a major person. I'm not a proletarian. I'm not an everyman. Although there's plenty of interpretations that say that. No, he's a powerful man. Not when he walks in that courtroom, though. Everyone there is doing everything they can over a long period of time to reach the law. But only in death, as I mentioned in the parable, near his death, he sees this very faint light. He can't quite tell where it is. He can't even tell if it's because I'm dying or if it's really there. The man at the gate, this so-called countryman, I don't wonder if that's simply another word for Gentile. It's hard to tell whether he's worried about his own people and their obsession with Talmudic law, although he was a student of the Talmud late in life, or whether this is a Jew looking from the outside of Gentile law, despite their privileged position. Now, it's very cliche to say that the individual doesn't matter. I don't care how powerful he is. The individual doesn't matter in the trial. But in any system, capitalism, Marxism, in any system, the individual really is an artificial irrelevancy. You notice that with the exception of Carl, the landowner, families aren't relevant here. These are isolated individuals as part of a machine. Joseph is powerless. Is it possible that he is guilty? He seems to suggest that he might be, but Jews can't see or don't want to see, hence their neuroticism, the sins that they commit, why, in fact, they're hated. Was Joseph actually innocent at all? There is guilt. He was a banker. So he's at least guilty of usury. But of course, a Jew isn't going to say that. He isn't going to understand that. So everything is going to seem bizarre. Everything is going to seem unjust. Not merely because they're a Jew, because usury is a way of life. Only the ignorant goyim think that this is criminal. So everything, thinking like that, is going to look arbitrary. It isn't. But that's their own anti-logos passions destroying them. Is the court Gentile society, or a very late stage Gentile society before the whole thing falls apart? And death is some kind of liberation. All of his novels, by the way, end in death. He doesn't say it's a liberation, but it is worth noting. I mean, after all, Judaism is a worldly occult system. It has no sense of salvation. It is a negation of the Old Testament, and certainly a negation of the prophets. Now, I want to mention the castle because it's too similar to ignore. There's another man also with the name K, no name attached to it. He is a land surveyor. Again, at the time, a fairly powerful and respected position. He is called to assist. And again, a castle, you're thinking an older, pre-modern, feudal society. There's a castle, a maze, and then a village. So the maze separates the village from the castle. The castle, again, is his projection of this evil bureaucracy, or at least this mechanical bureaucracy. There's a maze between the village, where the normal people are, and the castle, which is a mystery to everybody. So this huge maze, again, and the courtrooms in these tenements in the trial were also essentially mazes. My favorite part of the castle is when Kay is told, you are not of the castle. You are a stranger. You're a troublemaker. You're not one of us. He's a respected man with a respected position, yet he can get nowhere. No doubt in my mind. This is the Jewish world, as privileged as they are. They don't comprehend and, in fact, hate Gentile society. This is their projection. Zionism is based on the idea that this is a Jewish problem, not a Gentile problem. Of course we're going to see everything this way because they're not our people. Therefore, Zionism makes sense. We got to get out of here. And most of the right-wing parties in Austria, Russia, etc., believed in the Jews sent somewhere. And you had a strong Zionist minority, of course, who got much larger after the war. Again, Franz Kafka was extremely Jewish, especially in his adulthood. He went back and forth between socialism and Zionism, and like Moses Hess, ended up combining the two. He even was worried, Kafka was concerned with the loss of religious vitality, longing for God. But what he means by God, what any Jew would mean by God, is a whole separate issue. 1920 in Prague, because of the power of Jewish banks, their power over the state, he was terrified that the police had to hold back mobs from destroying their property. He did, you know, most of his, not all of it, but most of his later life, he only lived to 40. Palestine is his national home, but nowhere does he ever mention that this is the people of the Old Testament. His family was assimilated, but he opposed this, but he didn't do much about it. I mentioned the assimilation issue, of course, and that the people leaving the wars of Eastern Europe, coming to Central Europe, are more faithful to the Hasidic ideal. Jews are always, of course, a state within a state. I think what he's trying to say with all this is that it's not this distinction between religious and secular law that they're incompatible, but that Jews and Gentiles can't talk to one another. Gentile law, based on logos, natural law, is absolutely incomprehensible to Jews who live by passion and usury. I think, in a way, Kafka is fully admitting this. You know, which is a Zionist point of view. Banks, this is, of course, mostly in the trial. Banks, especially then, Rothschild banks lived off usury extracted from Gentiles. That, of course, is not a crime in Judaism. It is not unjust in Judaism. Of course, in Gentile life, it was. And that's the confusion. He is guilty of something, but either he doesn't know how to admit it or he can't admit it, and therefore everything seems arbitrary, even besides the fact that he shouldn't have been arrested in the first place. You know, so-called anti-Semitism is never based on Jewish behavior. But of course, we know it is. The time before World War I, during the war, the time in Bohemia where Kafka is writing, Jews at that point held most of the mortgages within the empire. Mass transfer of land to Jews whenever the bubble burst. And that land transfer, of course, occurred via debt. 10,000 farms a year in this period of time, just prior to the war, fell into the hands of Jewish banks. Karl Marx, of course, a generation before this, was in full agreement. In his Judenfrage, that Jewishness brought this cold calculation into, you know, Marx in his early writings was very harsh on the Jews. They rule Vienna, and Karl Marx was not shy about saying that. But Christian nations coming out of the feudal era, or so-called feudal era, were being taken over, if not by Jews directly, then by the Jewish spirit. That means that Kafka and people like him had no other option than to become Zionists and flee to Palestine, which, of course, he was never able to do. So it's not just Joseph in the trial, but Kafka personally, where his entire life revolved around the passions. Joseph, and this is a direct quote, says, "I cannot recall the slightest offense that might be charged against me. Not that I'm not guilty, but he can't recall something." Of course, oaths are canceled every year in Judaism. And I don't know German well enough to translate that myself, but this is the standard translation, and it's put in a very strange way. It should be noted, too, that the Italian painter, he had many paintings. He was trying to unload them onto Joseph. He had several of Lady Justice, and she seems to be running. It's also interesting, and no one ever gets the symbolism here, she's the goddess of the hunt with wings on her heels. Now, that's normally from Hermes or Mercury. And it's also closely connected with the mercantile life. Hermes is a trickster, can take many forms. That automatically makes him the god of commerce and deception. Because commerce can't exist without deception. Jews and Gentile society can't exist without deception. It isn't really absurd, although the coming war was certainly absurd. And by absurd, I mean something that's meaningless. The old existential idea that there is no ground to our existence. This is the anti-logos. This is a rejection of logos. Leads to either Nietzsche, who I guess was an existentialist in his own way, or the atheist Sartre, who despite, you know, being an existentialist, certainly was dogmatic in socialism and atheism. So much for existentialism. But at a minimum, the existential point of view holds that there is no defensible ground to, let alone anything that we may believe about ourselves, morally or otherwise, except socialism, of course, but to our very existence. Everything is contingent, and therefore nothing is absolute. In the trial, he is trapped in a machine, or what he sees to be a machine, with no origin. Now, on the one hand, the postmodern bureaucracy is very much like this. Anyone who's been through the court system recognizes pieces of this. But if your entire world revolves around the pursuit of power and sex, any break on your will is going to seem terribly oppressive. The drive for clarity, the drive for truth can never be satisfied in this point of view. And there's a lot of absurd elements in this story. Clearly, the arrest comes from out of nowhere. Actually, both of them come from out of nowhere. There was never any evidence of a crime, at least not presented to him. I have the feeling that Joseph knew that him and his people were committing crimes, just not crimes in Jewish law, which in and of itself is confusing. But at least as far as the story goes, nothing was brought out. Not even an arrest warrant. Number three, and this is very important in terms of the third entity, it could be all based on lies. It could be based on denunciation, blood libel, people making up stuff about the Jews because they're jealous, whatever it might be. The behavior of the agents who arrest him and kill him, which don't make any sense, including their supervisor. It may be mistaken identity, and this goes through the entire thing. In fact, in the castle, Kay shows up at the village, and it turns out to be a bureaucratic mistake. They never called for him. But you know what? You could work in the school system while you're here as a janitor. And again, everything is sexualized. Everything looks like a maze because the Jewish mind doesn't understand it. But I don't want that to eliminate the notion that modern bureaucracies, especially postmodern bureaucracies, operate this way. You complain about something, they'll tell you it's policy, which is irritating because it doesn't answer any questions. It's policy. In other words, it's not my fault. I don't make the rules. I don't know who does. And people think politicians are in charge of laws, and you actually go to Washington and you go, you know, to these institutions and you realize that they don't know what's going on. The judgments are completely arbitrary, at least to him. Yeah, a year later, he was executed, sort of. Although there's no judicial warrant for it, at least nothing that he brings out. On his 31st birthday, 3 plus 1 equals 4. 4 is the ancient number of prison, the square. And keep in mind, this man, there's a lot of, you know, pseudo-socialist analyses. Joseph is not a worker. He is upper class. He is from a privileged caste, but a privileged caste that has a lot of anger directed to them. Being a leftist socialist is bizarre because they will talk about capitalists and wealthy people and are terrified about mentioning the Jews, who as a group are by far the most powerful group of people in the Western world. Not to mention the fact that if you want to go on about the individual being helpless, the individual was liberated by the revolutionary ideologies of modernity. But this is the creation of mass society. Politicians campaign making promises that they have no power or ability to put into practice or to understand. The German process, P-R-O-Z-E-S-S, it's not just a matter of procedure, but in certain translations it could also mean entanglement. Crimes end up being defined within the court system, not outside of it. You know, contempt or something like that, which he is never accused of, despite him acting out sometimes. When I'm reading this, I read this in college, I read this in grad school, and I read it afterwards. I dusted it off again, and I had forgotten that one of the magistrates is, in fact, a porn addict, just like he was. Porn is everywhere. Again, how dare the Gentiles complain? We are the aristocrats of the world. Turns out that at his initial arrest, he had been being watched for some time. It really wasn't out of nowhere. It was, as far as he was concerned. The people who arrest him say that we were here to observe your reactions to being arrested. It seems that he is guilty of something. The reason that he was being watched, he just doesn't want to admit it. Joseph is described as a carefree bachelor businessman. In other words, he's lost in his own passions. He saw the trial, at least initially, as a big business deal. He was used to making those every day of his life. He thought this was going to be treated as anything in his banking life. The law, sometimes with a capital L, I know in German you use capitals for nouns, but I'm talking about it as a technical term. The law is inaccessible, regardless of, Jew, Gentile, whatever. The law is inaccessible to the masses, because the masses aren't capable of rising that high. But because of the nature of jurisdiction and the fact that you go so many different layers of court, by the time you get to the lowest one, it's not based on any ideals at all. An ideal, an ideology, when it's laid out on paper, sounds wonderful. But when it's imposed on a functioning society, it's no longer ideal. It has to force itself onto the already extant lives of people. That was my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott and the use of language in that process. That's what political violence is, from the top down. In the castle, people in the village justified the rule of the castle. They did not see themselves as oppressed. They saw the castle bureaucracy as imperfect, but they justified that in the sense that we're imperfect. So even if we had access to the law with a capital L, and of course we do through Logos, but he doesn't, and the masses don't, and a decaying empire like we live in now doesn't, although, again, Austria was a very humane, highly decentralized empire, but was struggling near the end, had the same system of courts as anybody else, but as things decay, lower courts don't, you don't go into traffic court and start quoting Hegel, Roscoe Pound. That's completely irrelevant. It's just practicality at that level. Ideals become very dirty the minute it's imposed onto society. But throughout, Joseph thinks that his reason is going to win the day. This Talmudic hair splitting, the pornography, the usher's wife tries to seduce him. But is the court really irrational, or is that just him? Was Gregor really a bug? No, he wasn't. He thought he was. His distorted mind keeps him from seeing his case in the court system correctly. We all know what bureaucracies are. It doesn't matter who's running it. Of course, back then, 100 years ago, well, actually, this is almost exactly 100 years ago. This was published. We're coming to the, we are at the 100th anniversary of his death. he is useful. Bureaucracies are like this, especially in the 20th century. Bureaucracies that existed prior to that were tiny. By comparison, they talk about a Byzantine or a Russian bureaucracy, and it was anarchy by comparison to the systems that we have today, both private and public. And it's unclear in the castle whether the bureaucracy of the banks is any better than the bureaucracy of the judicial system. They say nothing about anything else, not the legislature, not an emperor, not a president, not a prime minister, just how the courts work. Now, when he says my position and reason will win the day, I don't know what he's talking. Is he talking about his Jewishness? Is he talking about his money? Because he is a usurer. The manufacturer, Bloch, who I've only mentioned once, the connection between a arrogant banker and a manufacturer, of course, who the bankers dominate, even back then, Karl Marx, as well as the National Socialist, made a big distinction between productive capital and financial capital. This is why Marx had such harsh terms for the Jews early in his career, not later on. The Rothschilds saw to that. But remember, Bloch's case had been going on for 5 years. He has been suffering longer, and it's unclear what Bloch is religiously. B-L-O-C-K, it really could be anything. But a lot of this turns out to be perception, because even the Italian painter paints portraits of judges that don't look like them. They're not even close. They're highly distorted like everything else is, both because that's the nature of bureaucracy and mass society, where you don't have any law with a capital L. You simply have power. As far as that goes, it's true. But then you add the Jewish element, and anything the Gentiles do, especially when they don't think it's a crime, like usury, like exploitation of Gentile, is going to seem even worse. So it isn't as if he's making up a story about this bureaucracy that doesn't exist in reality. To the extent that that banking usury mentality takes over and liberalism and mass society come into existence, that's exactly what bureaucracy looks like. But that's not even in the nature of bureaucracy, at least in centuries past. It is today, because there is no truth. There is no law with a capital L. It's simply power. And one of the reasons that I don't vote, never voted, is because politicians have no connection to any of this. I love, you know, presidential candidates talking about their policy on taxes. Did no one tell them that they have no power over that? The legislature is supposed to set this kind of policy. Yeah, he could have his budget as much as he wants, but the power for that lies in the House, at least on paper. Politicians suggest that they have more power than they do. In fact, they have no control whatsoever over the economy. I don't know what the heck they're talking about. But again, Bloch, the manufacturing, by this point, 5 years or more, he is a broken man. Joseph is killed. He may have killed himself, but Joseph is killed before he reaches that state. Hold and Titorelli are really the only two mediators that he has. And even the women who try to help, none of them do, because none of them have really anything to say except that there's nothing to say. But it's clear that finance capital and manufacturing capital, represented by the two characters, are in the same boat. And this is a defense lawyer. You know, there is the concept of rent in a defense lawyer, where if you've ever been arrested and you're in jail for a while, then you make bail, you'll pay a lawyer anything to get out of there, to keep from going back. You'll put up your house, and plenty of people do that. So in a defense lawyer's fee, there is a strong element of rent, because they know the market doesn't matter when you're not in your right mind, and you will do anything to avoid a prison term. And this is why someone like Bloch is just in a state of slavish compliance. And it seems, when all said and done, the court really doesn't seem to do much against him. Except at the very end, he shows up. There was no summons. He just showed up because he thought he was going to settle this. Like when people start yakking without a lawyer when they get arrested. These cops are stupid. And of course, it never works out that way. It seems that whatever happens to him is done with his consent and the consent of people. I don't know if they're talking about the Goyim or what, but nothing happens without Kay's consent. But deep down, I think this system, despite the reality of bureaucracy in postmodern life, and this is not a postmodern bureaucracy here in Austria, the larger bureaucracies were in Paris and London, but the horrible, even the gaseous, nauseating elements of this system are a reflection of the Judaic mind deluded by their own passions. Yes, it's real, but not to that extent. No, you can't just walk in there, no matter who you are, and buy your way out. In 1922, Kafka referred to himself as a poor little man, obsessed by all sorts of evil spirits. He even goes so far as to say that advances in physiology, I mean, medicine affecting the body, the only good that does is relieve the real cause of illness, which is the mind. He knew himself as a mentally ill. So many Jews were, because of their very bizarre position, the nonstop cognitive dissonance. And I think that was projected onto the trial system. Of course, that became a reality, as Karl Marx himself said, as Christian nations fall under the Jewish spell, under the either the capitalist or the socialist spell, and they're the same thing as far as their priorities are concerned. But ultimately, it leads to mental illness, first to the Jews, and then anyone who they affect. The solution for Kafka was to leave Europe, which he never, was able to do. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.